Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Scott H. Davis, publisher of Jewish Storyteller Press, reviving Yiddish authors in translation, including the first ever release of Jacob Dinizin's The Dark Young Man. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shin Shiniot, Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's midsummer now, which means that it's Bastille Day today, the National Independence Day of France. And wouldn't it be nice to be vacationing in France right about now? Close your eyes, unless you're driving, of course, and think, if you would, for a moment about France. The Arc de Triomphe, the bridges over the Seine, the Eiffel Tower, wine, cheese, croissant with jam and coffee, great food, great art, lovely countryside, bicycle riders, a musical language, the tricolor flag, beautiful cities and very rude people. You know, France, far from the searing heat of a Western summer. France in time for Bastille Day. And so you ask, Rabbi, just what possible Jewish meaning can this have? Ah, I say, you probably don't know this, but the first nation in the Old World to guarantee full citizenship to Jews was revolutionary France. Without the French Revolution of 1789 and Bastille Day on this very day that year, Jewish history in Europe would have been very different. We are grateful to our own country of America, profoundly so, whose 4th of July we celebrated just 10 days ago, but we should retain some respect for the country that created the first Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and that benefited our people in particular. My favorite weird historical question that most people don't get the answer to is this: who broke down the walls of the ghettos in Europe, walls that had existed since the early 1500s? Who emancipated the Jews of Western Europe? Who made Jews full citizens in a non-Jewish country for the first time in history? The answer is Napoleon Bonaparte. You see, when Napoleon was conquering Europe in the 1790s and early 1800s, his armies were fighting, at least in theory, for liberty, equality, and fraternity. Napoleon had no love for religion in general, neither did the whole French Revolution, and certainly not for the old order of the church that had enforced so many terrible rules and constraints on Jews throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance and well into early modern times. And while Napoleon had no particular regard one way or the other for Jews, he was a non-commissioned officer from the island of Corsica originally, with little exposure to Jews, he had a very strong sense of the necessity to break down the old bad order, the Ancien Régime, that the revolution had deposed and sometimes literally decapitated. As Napoleon said, to the Jews as a commune, that is, a people, nothing. To the Jew as an individual citizen of France, all rights and privileges, which was a very great change and a great gift at that time in that world. And so, as French armies crossed Europe, conquering, plundering, establishing their own governments everywhere, they also, almost as an afterthought, broke down the walls of every ghetto they encountered and let the Jews out. And the French established, for at least a decent period of time, a new legal system, the Code Napoleon, which allowed Jews to go to universities for the first time, to serve in the military, to be part of the civil service, to live wherever they wanted, to live as full citizens. It was an extraordinarily important moment in Jewish history. France enabled us to enter the modern world, at least wherever its armies had control. The ghetto walls were never again established in quite the same way or with quite the same force, at least until Hitler came along. That meant that we Jews suddenly could experience all that the modern world had to offer, and it made possible the extraordinary successes and accomplishments and experiences of modernity in Judaism. It was while Napoleon-controlled Germany that Reform Judaism was born there, an Enlightenment form of Jewish belief and practice that catalyzed all modern Judaism, either inspired by it or in reaction against it. In the long run, it made possible Zionism and the State of Israel. It was earth-shaking. And it was all because of France. Nowadays, you are likely to hear a great deal of anti-French rhetoric in Jewish circles. There is widespread anti-Semitism in France. The many Muslim immigrants from the former French colonies perpetrate terrible acts against Jews. France supports the Arabs or the Iranians. There are anti-Semitic fascists on the right wing in France, and anti-Semitic yellow jackets and others on the left wing in France, and so on. But in truth, it is a much more nuanced picture than that. The French Jewish community remains the largest Jewish community in Europe. Paris has the largest Jewish population of any city on the continent. Past President Nicolas Sarkozy had Jewish ancestors and did a tremendous job both countering anti-Semitism and improving Holocaust education, as well as building the French relationship with Israel. France has created a strong curriculum in schools against anti-Semitism, providing effective Holocaust education. And the French government has consistently spoken out forcefully and prosecuted fully any and all anti-Semitic acts within France. So let's celebrate the French today as Jews. Bastille Day also provides us with a wonderful excuse to play a comedy cut from one of our all-time favorite Jewish comedians, the late and very great Alan Sherman. Here's a special tribute to France and Bastille Day itself, when the French overthrew the tyranny of King Louis XVI and entered the modern world. It's called You Went the Wrong Way, Old King Louis.
Louis XVI was the King of France in 1789. He was worse than Louis XV. He was worse than Louis XIV. He was worse than Louis XIII. He was the worst since Louis I. King Louis was living like a king, but the people were living rotten. So the people, they started an uprising, which they called the French Revolution. And of course, you remember their battle cry, which will never be forgotten. You went the wrong way, old King Louis. You made the population cry, 'cause all you did was sit and pet with Marie Antoinette in your place at Versailles. And now the country's gone kablooey, so we are giving you the air that ought to teach you not to spend all your time fooling round at the Folies Bergère. If you had been a nicer king, we wouldn't do a thing, but you were bad, you must admit. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine and shorten you a little bit. You came the wrong way, old King Louis, and now you ain't got far to go. Too bad you won't be here to see that great big Eiffel Tower or Brigitte Bardot. To you, King Louis, we say fooey. You disappointed all of France. But then what else could we expect from a king in silk stockings and pink satin pants? You filled your stomach with chop suey and also crepe Suzette's and steak. And when they told your wife Marie that nobody had bread, she said, let them eat cake. We're gonna take you and the queen down to the guillotine. It's somewhere in the heart of town. And when that fella there is through with what he's gonna do, you'll have no place to wear your crown. You came the wrong way, old King Louis. Now we must put you on the shelf. That's why the people are revolting, 'cause Louis, you're pretty revolting yourself.
Oh, never let it be said that Too Jewish doesn't provide the finest and highest sophisticated Jewish culture at all times and seasons. Of course, that was Alan Sherman. You went the wrong way, old King Louis. Our guest this morning is reviving the work of great Yiddish writers, including one of the most popular novels of the 19th century. Meet Scott Davis, publisher of Storyteller Press, and learn the remarkable story of Jacob Dinizon when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Scott Davis is the adapter and editor of one of the most important unknown Jewish great novels of modernity, Jacob Dinizon's The Dark Young Man, originally translated from the Yiddish by Tina Lunson and then presented in a new form and available in English, I think in an accessible and interesting English for the very first time. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Oh, good morning, Rabbi. Thank you so much for having me on your program.
It's a pleasure. So I have to ask you, this is kind of a quixotic project, reviving a great Yiddish author that nobody remembers. Tell us a little bit about how this came about.
Well, it is totally meshuggah. I mean, really it is, and I know it, and I admit it. And I tell people I'm not really sure if I found Jacob Dinizon or if he found me, but about 16 years ago, I started noticing the name of this Yiddish writer who was connected with many of the great Yiddish writers of the sort of late 19th, early 20th centuries.
Right, including Shalom Aleichem and maybe most importantly, Yitzchak Leib Peretz, the great Yiddish storyteller and author.
Yes, and in fact, Dinizon and Peretz were very, very close friends. And so I began noticing Dinizon's name, actually, in relationship with Peretz, in relationship with Shalom Aleichem. And I don't know if it was my background in public television, but I started putting together these dots. And as I started to put together the dots, I started finding out that this Yiddish writer who wrote the very first best-selling novel in Yiddish had never really received any attention in the late 20th or early 21st centuries. And I set out looking for stories by him or novels by him in English. Unfortunately, I don't read Yiddish, and I couldn't find any, and that sort of started me on the journey.
It's an extraordinary journey, and it's an extraordinary book. This novel, now entitled in English, The Dark Young Man, actually sold something like 200,000 copies in the late, not even so late, 19th century. That was an astonishing number for a book written solely in Yiddish for a not very wealthy Jewish public. Was it the bestseller of the 19th century among Jewish novels?
Well, certainly of Yiddish novels. And what makes that number so interesting is that this is Dinizon's number written to one of his colleagues. And that's the number of novels that were sold. Imagine the number of people who received the book, in a family or from friends. So it was a very significant number. In fact, when it first came out in 1877, Dinazon was living in Moscow, and he couldn't obtain a book himself. He actually had to go to a clandestine bookseller to purchase one of his to purchase a copy of his own book. And when the bookseller told him it was a ruble and a half, Dinazon was shocked. He said, "How can you charge a ruble and a half for a Yiddish novel?" And the clandestine bookseller said, "I don't bargain, and if I could have three books like this a year, I would never have to worry again."
It's a great story. We will continue to discuss Jacob Dinazon's book, The Dark Young Man, with Scott Davis when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in the foothills and northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is now located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us this Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road for Shabbat evening services at 6:30 p.m., with Saturday morning Torah study at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Join us for our second Shabbat at 2 Oracle Place, 7315 North Oracle Road on the west side of Oracle, north of Ina, and my new summer adult education course that starts this week, Talk About It, Gossip, Slander, and the Ethics of Speech, Tuesday nights at 7 p.m. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, teen programming, and rich array of summer adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community in southern Arizona during its exciting beginning year. We welcome our randomly occurring Two Jewish segment, Zen Judaism, Kohans, or Kohans of Wisdom about our journey. Be patient and achieve all things. Be impatient and achieve all things. Faster. Zen is not easy. It takes effort to attain nothingness. And then, what do you have? Bupkis. That was Zen Judaism, Moments of Mystical Peace on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail, or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And happy Bastille Day, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
We started talking last week about the use of language with regard to the border situation, talked a little bit about the condition of migrants at the border right now. But I want to come back to the use of language and the question of the word, the phrase, concentration camps, which was used by Congresswoman Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez, and which has become a flashpoint of controversy. A little history. The term concentration camp and the entity of the concentration camp was invented by the British in the Boer War for use against the South Africans who were rebelling against British colonial rule. And it was for white people, by the way, at that point. It obviously took on totally different meaning during the Shoah, during the Holocaust. What does it mean? How can we talk about it? Can anybody use that term?
So I think, again, there's a separate, more abstract subject having to do with the use of language and choices of words and phrases and how you make them and what choices are legitimate. Are any choices illegitimate? What are the circumstances, et cetera? That's kind of an abstract question. This is a very specific phrase. It's actually two. One is concentration camps, which the Congresswoman used, and one is the Holocaust, which I understand that the U.S. Holocaust Museum has said only Jews can talk about the Holocaust. There was no reference to the Holocaust by this Congresswoman. There was a reference to concentration camps, which, as you pointed out just now, existed before the German policy of eliminating all the Jews in Europe and exterminating them in camps that began as concentration camps because they brought them together, and then some turned into work camps and others turned into death camps. Not all the concentration camps served the same function or operated with the same degree of horrible efficiency.
Right.
It seems to me that given the history of the term and the history of the experience of, is it wrong to call the camps into which we put Japanese Americans during World War II concentration camps? They looked a lot like them.
They pretty much were. They were called internment camps, of course, Manzanar and the others. But really, they were concentration camps in all but name.
Right. They weren't necessarily death camps or work camps, but they were places where one group of people was concentrated so that the government could deal with them in a way that was different from the way in which it dealt with other people.
Of course. I mean, they were surrounded by barbed wire.
That's kind of the definition. And I don't think that we should automatically have a knee-jerk reaction that says concentration camp as a phrase can be used only to refer to the Holocaust and can be used only by Jews. I mean, I think that's historically not justifiable.
Yeah, it's not accurate. I do understand the sensitivity of people whose parents, grandparents, ancestors were put into concentration camps and then had to survive death camps as well, understanding that it changed during the Shoah, during the Holocaust. But the idea that this term is reserved exclusively for Jews, sadly, isn't true. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. An old man walks into a Catholic church and goes straight to the confessional. The priest pulls back the window. The old man says, "Forgive me, Father, for I've sinned. I'm 80 years old. I was walking home from the library the other day. Two college girls stopped their car and said they were on spring break and needed directions. We got into discussion. They offered to drive me home. On the way, one of them asked me the last time I'd had sex. I told them it had been years. So she said, would I like to have some fun? And before I knew it, the three of us were in my apartment. I had the most magnificent sex for two nights and the day between, and they're still there waiting for me and promised they'd show me things I never even knew a man and a woman could do. And that's why I've come to confession." The priest is shocked. He asks, "Sir, when's the last time you went to confession?" And the old man says, "Actually, this is the very first time." The priest says, "You're 80 years old. This is your first confession? Why now?" The old man says, "Well, because I'm Jewish." The priest asks, "In that case, why are you telling me?" And the old man says, "I'm telling everybody." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniyot. Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benacote, who are here with observations about this year here in America, well, representing, of course, the Weintraub Business Center and Israel in America. How did this change your identity? How did this change your Israeli identity?
So you can see the changes, you know, in the little details. And it's actually really funny. I mean, sometimes you don't even pay attention to that, but it's really just like the little things. If when you talk Hebrew, sometimes you have like an English word and then you add the accent a little bit and people are like, what? Or just eating dinner a little bit earlier.
Or when you go back. So a lot of it happened when you went back to Israel in January, right?
Right,
you
know, yeah. So when I got back, I was like, why is everyone so rude? Were they like that when I left? And, you know, and everyone around me are like, what? They're all acting the same. And I'm like, okay. But that happened when I came here. I was like, everyone is so nice. I mean, I don't know what to do.
Why are people so polite? But they're not necessarily any nicer. They're just more polite in America. I think it's
probably, it's really nice to see it and just like experience it for a year, you know, just like kind of like decide where you put yourself into it. Mm-hmm. And I bet that there are some things that will last with me even when I'll be back in Israel. Some things will probably change back.
For sure. Rota.
Yeah. So when I came here, I was always looking for Israeli stuff to keep me like in Israel, like finding Israelis or Israeli food or Israeli listening to Israeli music. And at some point of the year, I thought it would be a good idea to let it go and experience some American culture and American food, American music, American holidays. And I think when I'll go back to Israel, it will be the exact opposite. Like I missed Israel, but like I'll start listening to American music in my car, or like missing the American food and like missing American culture. So I think that's like that got into me. Now I have like I'm a little bit, a tiny bit American in me, because mm-hmm. I lived here for a year. I really feel that. Now I feel like it will miss me when I'll be in Israel, just like Israel missed me when I was there.
So, you know, it's interesting. You'll find yourself kind of caught between cultures, which happens. It would never have happened if you'd stayed in Israel. You never would have had that. Is that a good thing?
I think that experiencing different cultures than what you know is amazing. Like, I got the opportunity to be here, and like a lot of people do not get this opportunity. And I think that as much as you know and as much as you experience, as much as you know of other people than you, like the better you are, like, no, like the better is your perspective about the world, and the better like you know about like your knowledge is improving.
I sometimes think the biggest gap that you can find is between American Jews and Israeli Jews. They don't understand how different the cultures are, even though they're both Jewish, even though they're both rooted in many of the same things. And you guys can now bridge that in a really unique way.
Yeah, definitely. When we came here, we've noticed like, you know, the differences, but our goal, I mean, my goal is not only to bring Israel here, is also to show, you know, my community back in Israel, the side of all the Jewish community here, and show them like, look, there are so many like options. I mean, stuff that I really wasn't, you know, like
never
aware
about
to.
Before.
Yeah, I never thought about all those things. And it's really interesting because where I grew up and the way I grew up, I was never like aware of those kind of things. And I just always think how interesting it is. You just go all the way to the other side of the world, just like discover all those like new things.
Yeah.
I just want to bring it back with me and show it to everyone.
That's great. Thank you both. We will talk more next week.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Balak in the book of Numbers, which includes some of the best words an outsider ever delivered about our people. In the portion, one of just two in the whole Torah named after a non-Jew, 40 years of wandering have finally passed. The Israelites have arrived at the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in, and they seem unstoppable to their opponents. Balak, king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, to curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chances of defeating his own army and entering his land. Only the scheme fails. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet, but he is also an honest man who conveys only what God permits him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed, but only if God allows him to do so. And so, we are given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam the sorcerer three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to find that the words that come out of his mouth are not curses at all, but blessings. The last of these orations is a text that's become the prayer we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov. How good are your tents, Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow, the best laid plans of Israel's enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Without being deterministic, we know that in recent decades, many nations and organizations have planned the destruction of our people and of our country, Israel. Although their efforts have injured us, we ultimately have triumphed. Perhaps more importantly, the personal message of this portion of Balak is subtle. Usually in life, we intend to bring blessing, but often bring tsoras, trouble, instead. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we may find that even our less than nobly motivated actions can bring blessing in place of curses. It's all a matter of remembering the true source for inspiration and creativity, and therefore of blessing, which is God. Our guest this morning, Scott Davis, is working to bring back some fabulous Yiddish literature, including a wildly popular and somewhat scandalous novel that has just been published in a brand new edition, The Dark Young Man. Find out all about it and why it's a great read when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
More than 4,000 artifacts making up the collection of the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience traveled last month from storage in Jackson, Mississippi, to a brand new museum located in New Orleans. The museum is the only one in the world wholly dedicated to telling the history of the Jews of the American South. When the collection reopens next year in New Orleans, it will be easily accessible to the general public for the first time. Founded back in 1986 by a past guest of the Two Jewish Radio Show, Macy Hart, the museum was located for about 25 years at the Union for Reform Judaism's Jacob's Camp in the remote town of Utica, Mississippi. It did not always, in fact, even usually, have a full-time staff. There were many times visitors had to make an appointment to see it. The museum closed in 2012, put its collection in storage in Jackson, Mississippi, and the leadership tried to figure out what to do next. It took some time, but eventually New Orleans was chosen as the new location because it has a vibrant Jewish population, a big tourism industry, and it doesn't already have a Jewish-themed attraction. Museum officials predict about 40,000 people will visit this new museum every year. With the reopening, the museum will shift in its focus, according to its executive director, Kenneth Hoffman. The idea originally was to collect artifacts from congregations and families that were quickly disappearing from small towns and put them on display to preserve the artifacts, which is a great mission, Hoffman, a Houston native who grew up in Baton Rouge, said. But now what we're doing in New Orleans is going beyond that and attempting to tell a larger story about Jewish life in the American South. Back in 2017, the museum launched a $10 million fundraising campaign for the move and redesign. It has raised about $6 million through donations from individuals and family foundations. Jews have lived in the South since before the Revolutionary War, back into colonial times, but the bulk arrived as immigrants during the 19th century. Many started as itinerant peddlers and then settled in small towns where they worked as merchants. By the 20th century, young Jews were leaving those towns to study and work in larger cities in the South. Though some Jews remain in small southern towns, many synagogues have closed or are on the verge of shutting down. The Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience is the only physical space wholly dedicated to the study of the experience of Jews of this important region. You know, few people associate the American Jewish experience with the South, despite the region's rich history. But the Southern Jewish experience includes slaveholders and civil rights activists, high-ranking Confederate politicians like Judah P. Benjamin, and society women like Atlanta memoirist Helen Jacobus Apte. And, well, all kinds of other folks. I was a rabbi in the South for 4 years, and I can tell you it's a fascinating Jewish region. The Southern Jewish experience constitutes the most distinctive and arguably the most significant regional saga because the South envisioned itself as a separate, independent nation during the Civil War, said Professor Gary Zola, an old friend and head of the American Jewish Archives at HUCJIR in Cincinnati. Thankfully, this new museum of the Southern Jewish experience will soon provide the American public an opportunity to learn more about this vitally important facet of our collective past. Interactive exhibits at the new museum will address anti-Semitism in the South, how Jews reacted to the civil rights movement, Southern Jews in popular culture, and the religious customs of the region's Jews. If we want to get Jews and non-Jews to experience the museum, we have to be relevant, Hoffman said. We have to talk not just to the relatives or ancestors or descendants of small-town Southern Jews, but expand our mission. Talk about how Jews across the South made an impact or were impacted by their communities. One of our goals is to expand people's understanding of what it means to be a Southerner, he said, and what it means to be a Jew. In other news, German-Jewish film producer Artur Brauner, whose award-winning films include The Garden of the Finzi Continis and Europa Europa, died last week at the age of 100 in Berlin. Brauner was considered one of the most important producers in post-war Germany. Born in August 1918 in Lodz, Poland, Brauner fled Soviet Union in 1939 with his parents and four siblings, escaping the fate of other family members murdered in the massacre by German forces at Babi Yar. After the war, Brauner moved to Berlin with his brother Wolf, built a career producing popular films that later enabled him to produce films on topics closer to his heart, including a number on the Holocaust. As early as 1948, Brauner made a film about the escape of prisoners from a concentration camp. His 1955 film, The Plot to Assassinate Hitler, a fictionalized recounting of the failed attempt by Klaus von Stauffenberg to kill Adolf Hitler in 1944, won several awards. Brauner produced The Garden of the Finzi Continis, based on Giorgio Bassani's book about a Jewish family in 1930s fascist Italy, and that 1972 movie won an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. His 1982 film, The White Rose, Weiße Rose, told the story of a German anti-fascist resistance group whose leaders were guillotined by the Nazis in 1943. In 1992, Brauner produced Agnieszka Holland's film about a Jewish boy who disguised himself as a Hitler youth to survive the war. Based on the autobiography of Solomon Perel, Europa Europa won a Golden Globe. In 2003, Brauner produced a film about Babi Yar, where many of his own relatives died. In 2010, the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Israel named a new media center for Brauner. He reportedly called the recognition the crowning achievement of my film career. In all, over the years, Brauner's company produced 700 movies and TV programs. May he rest in peace. His memory will bring blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Scott Davis, the adapter and editor of Jacob Dinizon's The Dark Young Man, originally translated from the Yiddish by Tina Lundson. In addition to this being, as you said earlier, a kind of a Darfzain Meshuggah project to revive this, it connects you, and this book connects parts of the Yiddish literary world that I don't think anybody without a deep knowledge of Yiddish could have known before. Many of us have, you know, we think of Shalom Aleichem stories, or if we're fortunate, we know Peretz's incredible stories. But there was the tremendous Yiddish literary world flourishing in the 19th century. Dinizon is an exemplar of that. Tell us a little bit about kind of the context of all of this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there was an explosion of Jewish culture and literature between, I would say, maybe 1860 to about 1920. I mean, Yiddish literature went on beyond that, but there was this initial explosion of Yiddish literature that took place. Dinizon's novel was written in 1877. Shalom Aleichem and Ayel Peretz, they begin to have a presence in the late 1880s and into the 1890s. And that explosion of of Jewish creativity began being expressed in Yiddish. Up to that time, you know, the sort of the Enlightenment writers were writing in Hebrew. Most of the literati were writing in Hebrew. And it was really Dinazon who came to the realization that in order to reach the largest possible readership, he needed to write in the Mamaloshen, the mother tongue, which a lot of the enlightened Jews of the time considered a jargon, considered, you know, like a...
Not a real language, you know, exactly. Like sort of a bastardized version of German. They were, you know, the Haskalah frowned on Yiddish, loved Hebrew.
Absolutely. And so, and Dinazon writes to a literary critic, and he basically said, I suddenly realized that if I wanted to reach out to the people, you know, who I want to hear my ideas, I want to hear, receive these lessons. And in many ways, Dinazon was a teacher at heart. And in fact, Peretz sort of criticizes him a little bit as a moralist, as an ethicist, you know. But Dinazon realizes that if he wants to reach the readers, he needs to do it in Yiddish, and so he's the one that's kind of the proof of concept, because the book becomes so popular that that many other Jewish writers jump on the bandwagon, and actually that's a kind of an interesting part of Dinazon's story. Is he becomes so embarrassed by the schund, you know, the schlock that comes, that's written.
the pulp stuff that comes out, because it's a dramatic novel and a dark novel, really.
It is. So suddenly everybody's jumping on the bandwagon, and Yiddish literature gets, I think, a real jump charge from Dinazon's first novel.
So he's so embarrassed by all of these pulp novels that are coming up with their schmaltzy stories in Yiddish that he continues to write, but he doesn't publish for many years thereafter, if I understand correctly.
Yes, that's true. And I think perhaps it was when he finally meets Eyal Peretz in the 1880s or the 1890s, he starts to write again. Actually, and you know, when we talk about Dinazon and we talk about his connection with these other writers, you know, Shalom Aleichem comes to Dinazon in 1888 as Shalom Aleichem is starting up a literary journal, and he comes for publishing advice to Dinazon, and he asks him for a story. You know, because if Shalom Aleichem has a story by, you know, the author of the first best-selling novel in Yiddish, and he can put it in his literary journal, that's a marketing coup for him. And then a couple of years later, you know, Dinazon publishes Peretz's first book of Yiddish stories. He publishes out of his own pocket and then ships the books to Peretz. So he's really mentoring and advising these Yiddish writers. And then when he becomes really close with Peretz, I think Peretz finally encouraged him to get back into the marketplace, and he does. He then begins to publish again.
His story is also interesting, because not only is he an important author, but he's kind of a social reformer. He gets involved in humanitarian causes. He's really quite a guy.
He really is. Later on, first of all, one of the things about his books are they take on the issues that were facing his Jewish readers at the time, and he really addresses the social issues of the day. He talks about arranged marriages. He actually says, you know, in America they've abolished slavery, but we continue to enslave our young people through arranged marriages. He talks about the rigid gender roles that were in effect at the time. He talks about assimilation and how that was encroaching on the Jewish world at the time, and how modernity, you know, these modern ideas that were making their way into the world, at the turn of the 20th century, how they were challenging the traditions of the Jewish world. So he was taking on, in a very realistic way, presenting real characters dealing with these real issues that were facing his Jewish readers at the time.
So, coming back to the book, Der Schwarze Junge Mannschick, it's really a, when I say dark, obviously the dark is in the title, but it's kind of a story of destruction, right? The whole family. I mean, it's a powerful and interesting tale, but also very lyrical in its style.
Well, I appreciate you seeing that in the book, because you know, when you actually read the book, you can see why traditional publishers or traditional translators would shy away from a book like this. If you're trying to make a living at doing this, and you want a book to be really successful, you don't have a bittersweet romance. You know, you have a happy story, or a story, yes, you know, laughter through tears, as we often say with Shalom Aleichem. But Dinazon really presented that story with, you know, all of its dark sides, with, you know, the tragedy of the ending, and he really holds a mirror up to Jewish society. It's interesting, he sets it in 1840, but, you know, this is what was still going on in 1877 and continued going on in the Jewish world of Eastern Europe. Actually, wherever, you know, people were living, and they were in that traditional Jewish way of life, you know, they were still dealing with these issues. And Dinazon holds a mirror up and says, is this what we want our life to be like?
This is obviously a period of tremendous change in the Jewish world. This is a period when there's huge migration from the Russian Empire to the West, particularly to America. But what people may forget, since we all here in America are descended from the ones who left, is what an incredibly rich culture there was and how complicated the changes were that they were facing.
Yes, and it's very interesting because as Jews were coming to America, to the New World, you know, the land of milk and honey, life was getting
the golden
more,
Medina, right?
Exactly. Life was getting more and more difficult in Eastern Europe. In 1905, this is kind of interesting, in 1905, you know, there was a failed Russian Revolution, and Russian troops poured into Warsaw. And at that very time, an editor, it wasn't the editor of the Foreword, it was another editor of another Yiddish publication in New York, sends a telegram to Dinazon and says, come over, you know, you will do talks, we will celebrate you as a writer, and we'll even, you know, we'll give you a free steamer ticket to America. And Dinazon writes back and he says, I can't leave now. I can't leave my people as these Russian soldiers are wandering the streets of Warsaw, you know, inflicting violence on our people. So we often don't realize that this was a time that was becoming ever more difficult for Jews in Eastern Europe, under the Tsarist rule of Russia, and so that's one of the reasons why so many people left and came to America or went to South America and various other places, because it was just becoming untenable there.
When you were putting this together, you kind of allude to the fact that Yiddish very emotional language, can be a very long-winded language. How did you approach the editing process? Because there had to be some serious editing involved.
Yes, this was an interesting process because, you know, Tina Lundsten, who translated this novel, did a really wonderful job. And you know, I remember reading through it chapter by chapter as it came in, and to be honest, you know, tears welling up, you know, in various places along the way. But once it was all done, once the whole novel was done, and I, you know, tried to read through the entire manuscript, I came to realize that, you know, that there needed to be a way to somehow bring it into the 21st century for a reader that is used to language that we hear today. Now, it can't be completely, you know, a modern novel. It's not a modern novel, and that would be a disservice to what Jacob Dinazon wrote and to Tina Lundsten's a wonderful translation, but I felt like it needed to be tightened up. A lot of the very detailed, you know, Talmudic quotes that we really wouldn't comprehend today, most of us wouldn't comprehend today, which would have been very, very understandable to Dinazon's original audience, but for us, it would have slowed down the storyline. So there are places where that's there, but not in as many places as there were in the original novel. So it was simply a matter of tightening it up, trying to make the language more appropriate for a 21st century reader, while still trying very, very hard to hold on to Dinazon's spirit and the power of his original novel.
And I should note, Scott, you are an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. You've written books, Souls Are Flying, A Celebration of Jewish Stories, Hanukkah Tales from Oikvechnik. I think I got it right. Where can people go to find out more about The Dark Young Man and about Jewish Storyteller Press, your press?
Well, you know, this is the 100th Yahrzeit of Jacob Dinazon, the 100th anniversary
of his passing.
Right. And literally, in 2014, you could not find an English translation of one of his major works, and you could find very little information about him in English. Almost everything about him was in Yiddish. And so we've spent the last several years trying to have not only his novels translated into English, but also research information. We even had the only literary biography of Dinazon translated from Yiddish into English. That was done by Miri Korol. Two of his other novels were translated into English by Jane Pepler. And so much of that information is now online at jacobdinazon.com. And that's Jacob Dinazon, DINEZON.com. And it's interesting about his name because there are actually something like 16 or 20 different spellings of his name in English translation.
It's like Hanukkah, isn't it?
Exactly.
Spell it however you want.
Exactly.
Scott, thank you so much. The novel is called The Dark Young Man, and I recommend it to anybody and to Jewish book groups as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Colonel Shlomo Stav, the executive director of Sar-El, the Volunteers for Israel program. Our playout this morning comes from the Yemenite musical group, the Yama Ensemble, and their song Sapari Tama from their album A Basket Full of Stars. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sapari tamo tamemo, sapare nahil batemo. Sapari tamo tamemo, sapare nahil batemo.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.